So we are on this chapter towards the supreme secret, and there are six main secrets which we need to have before the supreme secret. So Sri Aurobindo has so beautifully named it towards the supreme secret, because otherwise we sometimes use certain slokas which is completely out of context. For example, one of the slokas which will come in the supreme secret is Sarva dharman parityaja mamekam sharanam raja aham tva sarva papebhyo mokshishyami masucha. So people take it that I'll go before, stand before the deity and say I am surrendering myself to you, and then all my papa and bhaya is gone, so I can commit fresh crimes. But that's why before we reach this point, there is he is summarizing actually in these five or six slokas the process which leads towards that. So toward the supreme secret is, there is a process we reach that point. It's not like a magic mantra. That magic mantra comes, but before that there are things to be done. And that's why he has used the word toward the supreme secret. And in that, we read last time, first thing was the Buddhi Yoga. If we follow the sequence of the Gita, we have Buddhi Yoga, Karma Yoga and the Bhakti Yoga leading us toward that supreme secret. So Buddhi Yoga is important because first thing is that the mind is so much engaged in this lower play. Lower and higher should not be taken as a pejorative term, but in the sense, well, lesser play. So in the lesser play, we have little bit of happiness, little bit of pain. If we are very fortunate, less happiness, more pain. If we are very unlucky, God has forgotten us, then we have a lot of happiness and we are on top of the world, that we are someone and something. So we have pleasure and pain, joy and sorrow, the play of dualities. Because the lesser play or the lower play is based on the ego self. Now we can look at this whole thing like a shadow play, where the real play is actually behind it. So ego self has to be replaced by the true self within us, not the true self of the Advaitin, which is beyond name and form, but the true individual self, which is the psychic being. So that's important, otherwise we'll be caught up in this play. And that's what typical Vedantin misses, which Sri Krishna brings forward in the Gita, that there is something called as in true individual self, which is a portion of the divine, of the Purushottama, the Jivatma, which is entered into this world of ignorance. Second, we have to replace desire, which is like the, you know, petrodollar fuel, which is getting out of stock everywhere. Because it's a limited, ego is always, the desire is always a limited fuel. And it leads to a lot of smoke as we go along its way. Because when we act under desire, true, we get some pleasure, maybe an instant gratification. But soon thereafter, there is a lot of repercussions. But this lower and lesser play is part of the training ground. It's like a practice match. Then when we go through it, then we are ready for the true play, which is freedom from desire. So what replaces it? When there is no desire, you see, this is the problem in traditional discourse of the Gita. They don't talk about all this. They say freedom from desire, nirvana, mukti, all this they speak. But if no desire, there is no desire, then how do you act? So very clearly, it is the divine shakti which will do the action. And when divine shakti does the action, it's one with knowledge, it chooses the goal, it does the work for us. So what we have to become? Just a channel. Surrendered completely. So therein comes the surrender part. So first thing is to disengage from the lesser play, meaning thereby disengage from the promptings of the ego, from the push of desires, impulses, which engage us in action all the time. And when we step back from this current, then we enter into a deeper sense of who we are and the divine, the higher inspiration under which we begin to act. And that becomes the higher play. This is the basic essence of the Gita. And its crowning movement is surrender, which is what is the supreme secret. But surrender, when we are in this lower ego and we just keep saying that I am surrendered, It's not a question of saying. Surrender means now I obey the divine will. I live for the divine. That's what surrender means. Otherwise somebody says that, you know, I have surrendered myself, but I'll do my way. I want things my way. So this is what we are. Sri Aurobindo is teaching us. So first thing is this. Yeah, page 532. Page 532. We had read till then, we had read it from page 528. We can read a little bit page 528 just to recapitulate. So we have a passage somewhere in the middle. The difficulty of human action. Page 528. The difficulty of human action is that the soul and nature of man seem fatally subjected to many kinds of bondage. So we must understand the bondage before we can talk about freedom. So what is the bondage? It's not somebody outside, but we have the bondage within us. The prison of the ignorance. First of all, we don't know what we should do, how we should do it, what should be the goal. This is the ignorance. Second is the meshes of the ego. Everywhere it's like me, mine, I-ness, minus. The chain of the passions, the hammering insistence of the life of the moment, an obscure and limited circle without an issue. So this is the prison in which we normally dwell. Who is this we which dwells? The soul. So there is something like the individual soul which the Gita affirms and Sri Aurobindo also affirms. Because there is a Vedantic discourse in which there is no individual souls. Therefore it is important. This soul shut up in this circle of action has no freedom. No desire, no leisure or light of self-knowledge or make the discovery of itself and the true value of life and the meaning of existence. So when we are caught in the ignorance, we don't know the value of life. We believe. Of course, we know the value, we believe. But we don't know the true worth of human life, which is to transmute it into a life divine. That's the ultimate value. But we don't know when we are caught up in the life of ignorance. And then from there comes very clearly that there are two natures within us. One which is centered in the ego idea and pushed by the desire. And it's not is attachment. This is one nature which we are all aware of. And there is another nature where we are rooted in the true self. We are bound inextricably to the divine. What a beautiful thing it is. And we are pushed by the divine shakti, by the divine power. We are not moved by desires and impulses. So these are the two natures which the Gita speaks of. So just to remember it, we have two selves, the ego self and the true, well, the Gita is not using the word psychic being, but from Sri Aurobindo's perspective, the psychic being, the true individual self. Gita uses the word mamaivansh, my portion. So it is a portion of the divine within us, which is our true self, as far as the individual is concerned. Through this door, we can reclaim our larger universal self. And we can enter into Brahman without ceasing to be individual. But that's a different story. And we have a double nature. One is the ordinary nature of ignorance. And the other is a higher super nature, which is a movement of the divine shakti within us. So this is the thing that the Gita wants us to remember. And then we come to just a few practices. We had read this last time, but we'll just quickly. So one is that one practice is that that we should practice inner quietude and neshkarmya. Neshkarmya is not doing an action, but the sense of non-doership. If I remember what I have done, Mother says once in one of the very beautiful illuminating things, she says, if you remember what you have given to the Lord, then the divine has no need to remember it. So it should not be that I have done this for the Lord. Then she says he will have no need to remember it. So, Naishkarmya means it's not that you are trying to forget. It's like you can't, it doesn't connect that I am a doer. There's a very nice bhajan of Dujendra Lal Roy, which I think I was referring last time. Tomar kormo, tumi koroma, loke bole koriyami. People think that I am the doer, but actually I am not the doer. I know it inside. So this is the first important step to be taken. It's called Naishkarmya. Naishkarmya means things are being done through. And people may think that you are the doer, but you have no sense of doership. And therefore you are forever free. So the bondage because of action comes from the sense that I am doing it. And it may be apparently good action, sattvic action, or it may be a mixed action. But as long as I have the sense that I am the doer, I am bound by the consequences. The day the doership passes away and it's transferred to the divine, that divine is the doer and we know it, not just intellectually, but in the stuff of our being, then we are not responsible. And that's exactly where Sri Krishna is leading us. That then the divine takes full responsibility of whatever is happening. Because that is the dilemma of Arjun. The context is that I am going to kill these people. So Sri Krishna says they are already killed. What I have to do? That you become only the instrument. Nimitta matra bhava sabhya sachi. If that becomes the state, then we are forever free regardless of the action. Because even a ghor karma like battle can lead us to freedom. But if that is not there and we are doing apparently sacred works, doing temple work or, you know, giving lectures or managing divine trust, still, as long as the feeling is, I am the doer, I am bound. So here it's not the type of action, but the inner state that is being revealed to us. So this is the first part, and he has made a distinction between Tyaga and Sannyas, we read last time. So Sannyas is when we outwardly reject action. And this is like the story of Alexander, cutting the knot or solving the riddle. So Gordian knot, we all know, the king of Gordias, he had tied a knot in a way and he said, whoever will open it will become the emperor of the world. So everybody tries, nobody is able to open it. And then Alexander goes and cuts the knot. He says, I don't care. He cuts the knot. So unfortunately, in English proverb, this is used to describe that he have solved a problem, but he never solved the problem. So he never became the world conqueror except in his mind. He came back from Jhelum, from India. See, the typical story, he cut the Gordian knot into two, but he never solved it. So as the story went, that if you could open it, you would be a conqueror of the world. So he never became a world conqueror, even though he set himself on that. But he came back from India, from the banks of somewhere from Punjab. So Sannyas tries to cut the Gordian knot. It says, why get into all this hassle? No life, no relationship, no people, no work. I'll stay in my calm. Most of them fall into tamas. That's different. Because they also start earning like that, and the people are there, and many of them, if you go in India, there are plenty. Some of them are all into drugs, they take hallucinogens, they get experiences, because it's an easy way. Some are genuine, on whom the ochre robe suits. Rare example is Swami Vivekananda. He wore the ochre robe and lived its truth. But most often than not, sannyasis end up deceiving themselves, deceiving the world, because it's so easy to do that. And then the robe, which unfortunately has become corrupted. So we are reading the Bhagavad where all this is described in great detail. So this is the first practice. And then comes this question, page 532. 7-8 lines from above. How, having attained this perfection, one thus attains to the Brahman? Hear from me, O son of Kunti, that which is the supreme concentrated direction of the knowledge. Now, in the Gita, it's very interesting that certain things that are there as part of the dialogue pass unnoticed. I mean, what does it matter how Sri Krishna has addressed him? But if we really look carefully, it matters. Because he is not discarding his other identity. He is not saying, listen, O Atman. He is addressing him as the son of Kunti. So it's a total reality along which Sri Krishna is seeing. The knowledge meant here is the yoga of the Sankhyas, the yoga of pure knowledge accepted by the Gita, Gyan Yogena Sankhyamam. So far as it is one with its own yoga, which includes also the way of works of the yogins, Karma Yogena Yoginam. So he basically starts the base from there, because that was the time when Sankhya was very prominently known. In fact, it was the what today we call as Gyan Yoga had taken this form of Sankhya Yoga. Basically it was become the witness self, separate yourself from the actions of nature. Slowly by your past impulsion, nature will push you, but as you become a witness, slowly you will become only those very necessary actions you will do. Maybe the morning requirements, then probably some religious services, and slowly you will drop the bondage. That's the Sankhya Yoga, which is Gyan Yoga will do it in a slightly different way. It will say concentrate on the one. Forget about all this. Traditional Gyan Yoga. But then this in the Yoga of the Gita is only a preparation for the Yoga of Works. So that means you step back, become a witness. But become a witness so that you can be truly moved and inspired to do the right thing according to the divine will. This is the basic difference. Couple of lines below. The Brahman indeed is both for the Upanishads and the Gita, all that is and lives and moves. It is not solely an impersonal, infinite, or an unthinkable and incommunicable absolute. So why he is saying that? Because one understanding of Brahman is the silent, impersonal Brahman. So when you enter into that silence, that's the last line. You have completed the race and you're done with it. But if you really look at the Upanishad, he is referring to the Mandukya Upanishad, where you see that Brahman is not only that impersonal silence, it is also the dream state, it is also the waking state. So Brahman is all this that is. In the highest sense, the divine is all this that is. But still, there are two aspects of this all. His immutable eternal self that supports existence, and his self of active power that moves abroad in the world movement. So this distinction is important both for pragmatic purposes. There is a state in which one can enter into a silent contemplation. And if this was all, then the right remedy would be practice meditation, practice more and more, start withdrawing from life, interact less and less and less, till finally you are done with. But this is only the base for a more dynamic movement of the same Brahman. So in one of the early prayers of the mother, she says the hours spent in contemplation and the hours spent in activity, both complement each other. Because through the action, we become more plastic, we become more consecrated, we begin to discover many things which are within us, you see. Typical person living in a cave, unmarried fellow, so-called, he's living in the cave, doesn't have children, he has no issues. But don't mistake that, you know, he won't get angry if you tell something. Because he has never practiced real life, real time yoga, which comes in life. In the life of an average human being, either your wife or husband will make sure that your ego is in place. If they don't, then your child will definitely put your ego in place, especially in today's times. So, which is wonderful. I take it as God's plan. So, but if you cut off from life and go into the solitude, interact with nobody and nothing, then you don't even know what are the tendencies within our nature. So, these tendencies come into play during action. And at the same time, as a complement, you must always have time when one withdraws into the silence, or at least the state of calm inner quietude. So these both of them are one reality in two poises. That's how Sri Aurobindo says. And both are necessary for the yoga of works. So there are these two aspects: his immutable eternal self that supports existence, and his self of active power that moves abroad in the world movement. So in the Gita, it is mentioned as para prakriti, that he is the one who has gone into all this movement. And there one can see this very, very clearly in the image of Shiva and Kali. So Shiva is lying, and on his breast is taking place the apparently reckless and wild dance of Kali. It's very amazing, because the story goes that when Kali started destroying, even the gods were afraid and they didn't know what to do. And then Shiva lies, and then as Kali dances on the breast of Shiva, her feet become steady. So just like when a dancer is dancing on the stage, can the dancer dance without the stage? You need a stage, and the stage should be formed. You can't dance on a waterbed. I mean, you will be thrown all around. So the Brahman becomes the stage, and the Brahman becomes the dancer, and the Brahman becomes the delight of the dance. So that's where he is leading us. So there are these two aspects. So first step is, of course, to enter into this state of impersonality. But here again, Sri Aurobindo described very beautifully, impersonality is a denial of limitation and division, and the cult of impersonality is a natural condition of true being, an indispensable preliminary of true knowledge, and therefore a first requisite of true action. So meaning thereby that normally we judge things very fast, we act very rashly, we have preferences, we have our own ideas, preferences not only emotional but ideative preferences. So we have to learn to step out of that, enter into an impersonality. And this is a very classic example of, I think, Ravindraji. He used to, his work was to distribute eggs in the morning. And he came from a typical, very traditional Arya Samaj background. So touching egg is a sin. So initially he would almost fumble when he would hold the egg, as if somebody asked him, how are you able to do it? He said, very simply, because I am not handling the eggs, I am obeying the mother. And there is a story of Rishabh Chanji, all of us might have heard it, that he was given work in the furniture department, where you have to kill the bugs. And for killing the bugs, you have to put hot water, and then the bugs will come out. When they come out, you have to kill them with stone. That was the ancient method. So he was given the task of killing the bugs. So he writes a letter to Sri Aurobindo that, though I am very happy to join and mother's work too, but probably being a European, she doesn't know that I am a Jain, I am not supposed to kill any creature. And so, please give me some other work. So Sri Aurobindo's reply is that, obey whatever the mother tells you, it will lead you towards the freedom and the transformation. Just listen to the mother. And he writes it that he took that's mother's command. See, in the Gita, Arjuna is being asked to destroy. Imagine a pure non-vegetarian, non-violent person standing there, sir, I am a disciple of Gandhiji, I can't do this. But look at what command is being given. So he says that, well, impersonality is preparing for that command. So impersonality means I have come out of my small, narrow personality, which is a product of a particular movement of time. In one particular life, we pick up certain things atavistically, habits, conditioning, etc. Now we can act on that basis, but then that is not divine action. Divine action flows freely, and that's why impersonality is important. Page 533, imprisoned in personality, we can only get a limited union by sympathy or by some relative accommodation of ourselves to the viewpoint and feeling and will of others. Recently there was a something being circulated, I don't know how valid or true it is. So the letter went that, well, we all will do some meditation for the war going on in Middle East. And this was done during Second World War to bring peace. Now, this is very nice emotional feeling. But if you see, in the Second World War, Sri Aurobindo had put his force behind the Allies. And similarly, in the Mahabharata, Sri Krishna is standing with the Pandavas. So wars sometimes are necessary to usher in a different age. which we don't understand. So while peace is important, but man must be ready for peace. Otherwise, he'll bungle everything. So a holy sentiment is very different from impersonality. So Shubhendu says, imprisoned in personality, we can only get at a limited union by sympathy or by some relative accommodation of ourselves to the viewpoint and feeling and will of others. Few lines below, last line on this same paragraph, to lose ego and be this impersonal self, to become this impersonal Brahman in our consciousness, is therefore the first movement of this yoga. And it's so beautiful once one even starts practicing a little bit, because the Gita says, Svalpamasya dharmasya trayato bhayato mahat. So sometimes a child may ask you a question, I tell you something which may be true, which you have not noticed. Now, normal reaction is, oh, you are a child, keep quiet. I am your this thing. Often people come and say, nowadays children don't respect elders. I say, thank God it is helping the elders, I hope. Because there was this feeling, just because I have lived longer on planet Earth, therefore I know. What an absurd logic this is. But, so you see, when you are impersonal, you will see there is so much you can learn from everywhere. Knowledge will come from every side. But if you have that little personality that I am this, I am a dad, I am an elder, I am a husband, I am a wife, or God knows what all we have become, everything except the one thing we need to be, that's the divine child. So as a result, impersonality is the first step necessary. It gives that stable ground on which the divine can play. Otherwise, every time we will hold back something of the divine by our own preferences. So basically it is about that, don't bring your preferences. So question is, how then is this to be done? First, says the Gita, page 533, through a union of our purified intelligence with the pure spiritual substance in us by the yoga of buddhi. Now this is something Shurbindo uses suddenly in between. He is not just saying that, you know, the buddhi has to withdraw from the surface life of senses and the mind, but into the pure spiritual substance. There is something like a spiritual substance out of which the material substance has come. If you look at it, after all the gods of Lord, I mean the godheads of the overmind and even the divine, he gives a darshan. Darshan means there is a name and form he assumes. What is that form he assumes? There has to be a substance of which he assumes a form. Very plastic, comes and vanishes. Niruddha's sister was describes that once, Niruddha told her that once he saw Shurvindo get up to fetch a book from the cupboard, and suddenly he saw that there is no physical, like in between, there is a little silhouette, and in between there is complete vacant, and he could see through his body to the cupboard and the books and everything. It was like the true substance, but at the same time it has materialized with a certain purpose. Now once you have that experience, people had this experience with the mother, it's documented. Suddenly they would see her tall, suddenly they would see her short, and then all this thought that where is Shurbindo now, that Shurbindo is not there, will be sound so absurd. And even in vision, when we see the Divine Mother and when we see Shurbindo, and that is so concrete and it has impact upon your life, how can you discard that there is only this material substance? So there is a spiritual substance which we may not know, because our senses are completely tied and bound to the gross material sheath. But there is substance of which dreams are made, the stuff of which dreams are made, and a substance which is still deeper, subtler, and that the divine assumes in different ways. So this is the first thing, through the yoga of knowledge. And what does it bring? This spiritual turning of the buddhi from the outward and downward to the inward and upward look is the essence of the yoga of knowledge. So we'll see that many times, you know, people are busy with the outward things. Oh, is the light too much? Is it too hot? Do we need a greater AC? And what food will be served? If the mind is engaged in all these things, or the downward tendencies, that after a nice talk on the, you know, in Jorhat, I had just a casual, I was staying in somebody's house. So in the morning, over a cup of tea, we were talking about Bhagavat. And my favorite subject. So we started talking 2.5 hours over tea. So the lady of the house says, how come you're talking all this? We have Bhagavat Saptas, where 1 week they take whole 1 week Bhagavatam. And they don't tell any of these things. They just tell the stories which are there. So I said, what happens after that? Said they, when we give them money, they say nowadays that don't give like this, you give in cash. So that, you know, I said, this is the problem. Because the eyes are on money. It is not on the Lord and the joy of the Lord. So when your eyes are on the money, then this is what will happen. Or your eyes on prestige or on ambition. So you see how it can masquerade. How difficult it is to be really free inside. So the Gita is pointing out the buddhi should be turned inward and upward. This is a persistent practice, because every time the senses pull and say, oh, how hot it is. So it should be reminded that, look here, let me live in the coolness of the divine, sweetness of the divine. Every time somebody says something which is hurtful, say that, well, mother's sweetness is with me. So always to turn inward. When something happens which outwardly may not be very pleasant, vigat spreha, that's the word we heard. And then we turn upward, that how this is going to bring me closer to the divine. So this is the buddhi yoga, very simply. That for every situation, circumstance, event, we turn inward and upward, so that the whole thing becomes a means to draw us closer to the divine, further and further. So this is the practice. So here it is, few lines below. The senses must abandon their objects. The mind must cast away the liking and disliking with these objects excite in it, for the impersonal self has no desires and repulsions. So this is what is sometimes understood as senses must reject the objects, means abandon. That's not what it means, because you can be completely with an object and completely free from it. You see, Sri Aurobindo's own life is such an example. Once when he ate the whole food and there was no salt in it, and nobody came to know. After he would eat very little, and when they were eating, he said, but sir, there was no salt in it. He said, yes, but there is an ananda of that also. So he didn't. He said, why didn't you tell us? He said, there is an ananda of that. And how he describes in Alipur jail. But at the same time, when, you know, three types of Brahman, when three types of Khichdi. And then one day, when mother is not around, so Champaklalji asked Sri Aurobindo, sir, there is Pantua. Would you like to try? Now, Bengalis are very as such fond of Pantua. But obviously, Sri Aurobindo didn't ask for sweets. But that day, the Pantua was there and the mother was not there physically. Otherwise, he would take whatever mother would give. So, Champaklalji asked him, sir, there is Pantua. So, Sri Aurobindo said, if it is Pantua, I can try it. So, it's not like, oh, no, I have to. It's not about physical abandonment. It's about inwardly you are free from that. If you have it or you don't have it, it's not like becoming tasteless. That's not the idea of this yoga, at least, or the yoga of the Gita. So this is what he is pointing us. So there has to be an entire control has to be acquired over the mind, speech and body, over even the vital and physical reactions, hunger and cold and heat and physical pleasure and pain. The whole of a being must become indifferent, unaffected by these things, equal to all outward touches and to their inward reaction and responses. This is the basic practice. And then he would qualify it. Couple of lines below. There has to be a complete cessation of desire and attachment. This is the vairagya. So, it again, detachment is not you have to be away from an object. That's another kind of attachment, because you are afraid. You know, the story of Shukdev and Vyas Rishi, when they are walking across the bridge. So there are some women who are bathing, and naturally when they are bathing, old time India, so they are half covered and all. So Vyas Rishi becomes a little conscious as he walks, that I shouldn't look that side. Shukdev walks very coolly, looking everywhere. And when Vyas Rishi walks, the women try to cover their body. But when Shukdev walks, they just remain whatever they are. So he asks, what is the reason for this reaction? So then, as the story goes, this from the Bhagavad, that when Vyas Rishi was walking, because in his own heart, there were certain vibrations, feelings. So the women responded to that. And Shukdev was completely free inside. So there was no reaction or no response in them because they didn't. So it is all about the law of vibration. It's not about a physical object being there or not. As I was saying, one of the famous Swaminarayan Sampradaya people in Nairobi, I was giving a talk and the women had to sit behind. So I had to give a talk starting with Brahman. I said, we have excluded half the Brahman. So why they were, I said, why are people afraid? Why should they sit behind? And well, they believe in it. They even speak about that His Holiness to whoever asks half the Brahman. This was a kind of, but that's not the yoga of the Gita. The yoga of the Gita accepts life, but the reaction, the understanding is completely different from the same thing. There has to be a complete cessation of desire and attachment. And therefore, meditation and then the last line is very beautiful. And yet the object of this austere discipline is not to be self-centered in some supreme egoistic seclusion and tranquility of the sage and thinker, averse to the trouble of participation in the world action. The object is to get rid of all ego, that's all. Not that, you know, I am happy in my seclusion. I don't go out. People would, you know, the Swamijis who never go out because, you know, they are probably afraid or whatever. That's not the object. The object is there is an inner freedom. So when you act in the world, you can act as the divine would want you to act. So he speaks about one has to put away utterly first the rajasic kind of egoism, egoistic strength and violence, arrogance, desire, wrath and sense and instinct of possession, the urge of the passions, the strong lusts of life. But afterwards must be discarded egoism of all kinds, even of the most sattvic type. For the aim is to make soul and mind and life free in the end from all imprisoning I-ness and minus nirmam. So including the I-ness and minus of the saint, the I-ness and minus of the so-called yogi. All this one has to get rid of because they are the subtlest of illusions. So this is how the Gita continues. So impersonality. And toward the end on this page, the renunciation of their objects by the senses, vishyam tyaktva, is to be of the nature of tyag. It must be a giving up of all sensuous attachment, rasa, not a refusal of the intrinsic necessary activity of the senses. Means I don't have to mix khichdi and rasagulla and, you know, all kinds of things and eat together. I don't have to. I know the difference, but I am not bound by it. I am not hankering after it. I am not attached to it. That is the difference. I am not blunting the senses that I'll eat without this, without that. So this is where the Gita reminds us. Because if the senses stop functioning, that is also not healthy. Mind stops functioning. That's not the goal. It is to make them channels. One must move among surrounding things and act on the objects of the sense field with the pure, true and intense, a simple and absolute operation of the senses for their utility to the spirit in divine action and not at all for the fulfillment of desire. So this is where one has to act, but act for the fulfillment of the divine will. So page 535. Second line, and this is asked not for extinction, but in order that there may be a perfect enabling equality in which the spirit can give an unhampered and unlimited assent to the integral and comprehensive divine vision of things and to the integral divine action in nature. A continual resort to meditation, dhyan yoga, nityam is the firm means. So this dhyan yoga is not sitting in a certain state. It's about being indrawn, being upward, turned upward. That's what can lead to a constant state of meditation. Regardless of where you are, what you are doing, you are interacting, even speaking. But your consciousness is turned inward and upward. And last few lines on this same passage. But in the Gita's path of Tyaga, it is a preparation rather for the turning of our whole life and existence and of all action into an integral oneness with the serene and immeasurable being, consciousness and will of the divine. And it preludes and makes possible a vast and total passing upward of the soul out of the lower ego to the inexpressible perfection of the supreme spiritual nature, Paraprakriti. And then comes this line. When one has become the Brahman, when one neither grieves nor desires, when one is equal to all beings, then one gets the supreme love and devotion to me. So there is this love and devotion develops when we are free of all these, you know, desire and egoistic elements and preferences, then the true love and devotion develop. And then we are really ready for the divine action. But in the narrow path of knowledge, bhakti, devotion to the personal Godhead, can be only an inferior and preliminary movement. That's why the language of the Gita seems sometimes so contradictory. Because Sri Krishna first tells him, no, you must practice buddhi yoga. Don't get into rushing for works. That's why Arjun gets confused. He says, after all this, you told me to practice buddhi yoga. So then why are you asking me to do this ghora action? Why you want me to engage in this kind of a sanguinary action? So Krishna would say, hold on. This is the first step. After you have learned to disengage from all these desires and fruits, then you are ready for that true action. And then only we are ready for the true bhakti. Because this is one of the commonest thing in India. Often we hear, oh, he is a bhakta. Why he is a bhakta? Because he goes every day to the temple. He does all the prayers. But what is in his heart? There used to be a person who would sit for many hours in closing his eyes. And someone asked Sri Aurobindo, oh, sir, he meditates so much. And Sri Aurobindo's reply, yes, but on his wife. He knew what is going on inside. It's not closing the eyes. Meditation is never about closing the eyes. Meditation is an inner state. We all know when you close the eyes, the donkeys dance much more. Because otherwise the eyes are keeping you hooked to some object. You know, it's better to look at the mother's picture. Your eyes are at least, you know. But if you close the eyes, then all kinds of pictures which you have kept inside, held neatly hidden from the subconscious, they begin to rise. So, meditation, the reference is being concentrated inwardly on the Lord. So, what is important? Next page. There is no longer the lower blind and limping action of the ego and the three gunas, but instead the vast self-determining movement of an infinite spiritual force, a free immeasurable Shakti. So when desire is gone, doesn't mean that there will be no action. There will be much more powerful action. At one place, Sri Aurobindo says that the yogis, true yogis, they are much greater creators. And we have examples. You see Vyas, Valmiki, Kalidas. Kalidas is sensuous. All three are yogis. And the way he describes all about, you know, the other worlds as if he has an occult vision and occult seeing. They are all three yogis. Wordsworth, he is a yogi. Sri Aurobindo speaks about him. William Blake. Some of them, you know, they were all yogis. But they were seeing with another vision. So they are great creators, if you really. They are also warriors. If you really look at, even in India, we had recently that Guru Gobind Singh and Shivaji. Both Guru Gobind Singh is a recognized guru, and Shivaji, though not a recognized guru, lived only for the sake of the fulfilling the mission of the Shakti and great warrior. Arjun is a yogi. So they are much more mighty in action because they are freed from the trappings of the ego and desire, maybe for a special action sometimes or as a way of life. And Sri Krishna himself, Sri Rama, all that we are reading, The father says that, well, I have given my word to your mom and I am sorry, but you don't have to listen to her. That's what Dashrath tells him, because he is very unhappy, as he has promised to Kekayi that whatever you ask, I'll give you. Then one day she says, send your elder son to forest and the younger will become the king. So he is very disturbed, and somehow Ram comes to know. Lakshman is very angry. He said, we will capture your father, our father. He is gone senile. That's what he says. He is very angry. He said, no, no, tomorrow you will have the coronation. And Rama goes, listens, says, no, my mission will be fulfilled if I go to the forest. Look at the equality, freedom from desire, totally, you know, what does forest mean to a prince? And look at his wife Sita walking into the forest. So, such an amazing story. She doesn't think twice and she tells him, well, that's my dharma, finished. She's not thinking what dangers may come on my way. This is the stuff of which these great yogis are made. So, and therefore we have few lines below that an imperishable portion of the Supreme Godhead, an indestructible power of the Supreme Prakriti, Mame Vansha Sanatana Para Prakriti Jiva Bhuta. The soul of man then feels itself to be one in a supreme spiritual impersonality with the Purushottama. Then, what does it feel earlier? Identified with the ego. It says, I am Mr. So-and-so, I have this opinion, I have this viewpoint. But when it gets into this state of yoga, it knows itself as a child of the Divine Mother. And that closes the chapter. And in its universalized personality, a manifest power of the Godhead, its knowledge is a light of His knowledge. Its will is a force of His will. Its unity with all in the universe is a play of His eternal oneness. So this is the state where the Gita leads us, where we are freed from this limited personality, limited viewpoints, opinions, desires, preferences, and we are freed, liberated in the consciousness of the divine. That's why one of the flowers is called attachment with the divine. Very interesting. Because traditionally, you are not supposed to be attached to anything. But here, there is the secret. If you are attached to the divine, all other attachments fall away. And incidentally, I'm sure we all know, this flower lasts really long. But it needs very little water. It's one of those flowers you will get with those little water. It can last very long. It's called attachment with the divine. There are different varieties. One is an integral attachment with the divine. So attachment with the divine frees us from all other attachments. We don't have to struggle, fight, oh, I am attached to this, I am attached to that. No. Get attached to the divine. And automatically. There it is. Yes, yes. Attachment with the divine. So lovely. And this is the psychic attachment. No, this. So, yeah. So this is frees us from everything else. So we have to turn these movements toward the divine. And therefore comes in the end, few lines below, and in that unifying realization, adoration, love and devotion are not only still possible but are a large and inevitable and a crowning portion of the highest experience. So love comes at the end. We are not ready for love. Love and demand don't go together. Love and service go together. Love and surrender go together. Love and complete obedience of the divine go together. But love and demand and desire don't go together. So when Sri Krishna says Buddhi Yogi is superior, he is saying first get rid of this clamoring of the lower nature, which is wanting, desiring, demanding. Don't call it bhakti, that you are going and doing, you know, this Hanuman Chalisa, reading this book and that, and you are hankering, if I do so many times, then I will get this benefit. That's not devotion. That's okay. It's a kind of movement. As the Gita says, there are four kinds of devotees, arth and artharthi. But they are not in the path of yoga. That's in the life of the world. But for yogi, first there is the knowledge. That's how the Gita describes the four types of yogi. The seeker after knowledge. And the highest devotee is the knower. He knows the divine is everything. He knows the divine is everywhere. So he is not afraid. What does he demand and desire? constant nearness of the divine. So this is the basic thing, that this is the highest love and adoration. The one who eternally becomes the many who in their apparent division are still eternally one, the highest who displays in us the secret and mystery of existence, not dispersed by his multiplicity, not limited by his oneness, this is the integral knowledge. So a person who is truly liberated inside finds the divine everywhere and in everything. So while he has the Matri Mandir, he always has the Matri Mandir inside, which is open 24/7. He goes to the Samadhi and takes delight in even that external manifestation, but the Samadhi also dwells in his heart. So always he can be in that peace, bathing in that peace. This is the state of the liberated person. Even on the battlefield, he is one with the divine. So this is the state where the Gita is taking us. He doesn't say ki this is God and this is not God. Everything, every human being, every creature of existence, every atom of existence becomes for him something of the divine. Okay. So he is not dispersed by his multiplicity, not limited by his oneness. This is the integral. Not dispersed by multiplicity and not limited by his oneness. What a wonderful passage this is. This knowledge comes, says the Gita, by a highest bhakti. Now you see it takes us to what bhakti? And this bhakti is of the nature of complete self-giving to the divine. Complete surrender with no other motive except union with the divine. Whatever way the divine wants us to be, that I shall be. That is the highest bhakti towards which the Gita is taking us. And what is this love? This love is not about jumping, dancing with nice, you know, cymbals and crying and praying and loudly shrieking. What is the nature of this bhakti? See, it described a few lines below. Okay, page 537. Devotion to a love that is calm and deep and luminous with widest knowledge, to a supreme delight in God and an illimitable adoration, the unperturbed ecstasy, the spiritual ananda. Everywhere, in everything, when you find the divine, it's such a delight. Even in the most difficult, impossible situations and circumstances. When you are alone, you have the delight of the divine in your loneliness. When you are in company, of the delight of divine in multiplicity. Everywhere the sense of the divine. This is the highest bhakti. When the soul has lost its separative personality, when it has become the Brahman, it is then that it can live in the true person and can attain to the supreme revealing bhakti for the Purushottama, and can come to know him utterly by the power of its profound bhakti, its heart's knowledge, bhaktya mam abhijanati. So there the divine begins to reveal himself as the samagram mam. Everywhere and in everything, the divine reveals himself. So it's a very highest kind of bhakti, where highest knowledge, and we see in Savitri, when death tells Savitri, you know, you are loving like an ignorant human being, you should have knowledge. And what does Savitri says? I will have knowledge when I have loved all. Because I know that love is a vast vision. Love is not about a little personal sentiments and jumping and running and crying and laughing. Love is something very vast, profound. It's the power that drives the cosmos. We have in Paradise Lost, Dante is that Beatrice tells him, I came to meet you because of love, love that moves the stars. That is the power of love. Samagram mam gyatva. He comes to know me, says the Gita, who and how much I am, and in all the reality and principles of my being. This integral knowledge is the knowledge of the divine present in the individual. It is the entire experience of the Lord, secret in the heart of man, revealed now as the supreme self of his existence. The sun of all his illumined consciousness, the master and power of all his works, the divine fountain of all his soul's love and delight, the lover and beloved of his worship and adoration. It is the knowledge too of the divine extended in the universe, of the eternal, from whom all proceeds, and in whom all lives and has its being, of the self and spirit of the cosmos, of Vasudev, who has become all this, that is, of the Lord of cosmic existence, who reigns over the works of nature. How nice if one day we can live this reality when somebody says, where do you live? In the mother. Address, in the heart. Whose heart? Everybody's heart. Try to find now, figure out. So beautiful it is, so powerful. So this is how the soul of the liberated man enters into a reconciling knowledge. And finally, page 538, such a person arrives at the highest spiritual perfection. And by doing also all actions always lost in me, he attains by my grace the eternal and imperishable status. He does everything. And yet all these actions are done in the Lord, for the Lord, by the Lord. This liberating action is of the character of works done in a profound union of the will and all the dynamic parts of our nature with the divine in ourself and the cosmos. It is done first as a sacrifice with the idea still of ourself as the doer. I do the sacrifice. It is done next without that idea and with the perception of the Prakriti as the sole doer. It is done last with the knowledge of that Prakriti as the supreme power of the divine and a renunciation, a surrender of all our actions to him with the individual as a channel only and an instrument. This is the highest stage when one becomes nothing else but a channel and an instrument. So all things towards how to make this channel and instrument more and more perfect. Wherever things are clogging, blocking, because of desires rising up, because of reactions, because of limitations, because of imperfections, that have to be cleared. And they all get cleared again by the divine Shakti itself, because it's not human beings who can do it. These divine works, few lines below. So he says, what happens? This is done really by him through his universal Shakti, the divine universal Shakti. These divine works, whatever their form or outward character, cannot bind, but are either rather a potent means for rising out of this lower Prakriti of the three gunas to the perfection of the supreme divine and spiritual nature. And it's so simple and logical. If you want that the divine knowledge flows through you, if that is the aspiration and the mind opens, then what will happen? There will be perfection of knowledge. And because it flows through the brain, the perfection of the brain. If you want that only the divine vibration should be transmitted through speech. If you want only the divine loves through you, all whom we are connected with in life. So the love in the human heart will enter into a perfection of the divine love. If we want that life should only and only be lived for the divine, for the delight of the divine, then slowly the life force, struggling, egoistic, full of joy and sorrow, will become a pure channel of the divine delight. And if you want that this body should become only a tool in the hands of the divine, then it will arrive at its highest consummation and fulfillment. So we close with this. Disengaged from these mixed and limited dharmas, we escape into the immortal dharma which comes upon us when we make ourselves one in all our consciousness and action with the Purushottama. That oneness here brings with it the power to rise there into the immortality beyond time. There we shall exist in his eternal transcendence. So this is where the Gita takes us. And once we have done this practice, then we are ready for the supreme secret. Because otherwise we'll just talk about it and we'll say, I have surrendered myself to the divine. As somebody said in one of the classes, Mother, I have already finished the surrender. Now you take up some other subject. Mother said, oh, you could finish it. In 1 week you have surrendered. So, of course, the word is easy, but very difficult. Because it means to live for the divine and not for the ego. To live by the divine and not by the ego and the desires. And to live in the divine and not in any other different, all kinds of mental formations, prisons in which we live. Okay, so we'll close here. April, next class.